Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the post-Thanksgiving frenzied shopping sales on Black Friday, which were down over 11%, and get an appraisal of this weekend's demonstrations against Walmart from Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute and author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalism. We will discuss Josh's research that finds from 2007 to 2010, median American family wealth declined 38.8%, while the wealth of the Walmart heirs rose 22.1%, making the Walton family fortune equal to the wealth of the bottom 49 million American families. Then, at the one-month mark by which the White House had pledged to fix the healthcare.gov website, we will get an analysis of how the troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act is proceeding and whether public confidence in healthcare reform can be restored in the remaining time left to get the insurance exchanges running. Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, who helped prepare the Patients' Bill of Rights that has been enacted in many states, joins us to discuss the status of the website and the prospects ahead for Obamacare. Then finally, with many right-wing bishops alarmed and many left-wing priests encouraged by Pope Francis's latest pronouncements, we will look into what kind of a reformer the new pope might be with Jennifer O'Malley, a Roman Catholic woman priest, and Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. They join us to examine the tectonic shifts underway in the scandal plague church, whose new leader has made provocative statements of late that are at odds with the rigid and reactionary dogma of his predecessors. And joining us now is Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute. He's the author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Bivens.
Thank you for having me.
And Josh, your research has revealed to us the shocking, we know about the disparity in wealth in this country and the growing disparity in wealth in this country, but it is particularly egregious when you consider that the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, the six children of the Walmart founder, they are now worth $89.5 billion. Oh, this is in 2010 when you did the research, which is the equivalent to the bottom 41.5% of all U.S. families combined. On this, after the Black Friday sales, et cetera, and Walmart was also open on the Thursdays, on Thanksgiving, which is normally a family holiday, my understanding is that overall Black Friday sales were down 11%, but Walmart are claiming that in spite of the demonstrations, their sales were up. So what do you know about that?
Not a lot, except for what you just said. I mean, we sure don't have sort of a official data on consumer sales overall from the government. We won't have that for a couple of months now to know how the retail sector is doing. And when it comes to individual stores or individual corporations like Walmart, we kind of rely on what they report to the public. I mean, I guess in the end of the year, we can look at their official annual report that they give out to the shareholders, and one imagines they will be pretty honest in that one. But in regards to the numbers they're going to report in the midst of this kind of politically contested Thanksgiving weekend, we don't have any independent check on any of that.
Well, I've seen press reports and pictures of Santa Claus being arrested out here in Ontario, California, demonstrating against Walmart. What's your sense of did the mainstream press cover this adequately or at all? Because obviously Walmart is a big advertiser for both newspapers and television stations.
I think it was a huge leap forward from previous years when there have been sort of more sporadic, but there have been protests against Walmart on the Black Friday weekend. I felt like, you know, and I have a very biased sample of media that I look at in terms of the small number of things, but I feel like it's got much, much more attention this year. I feel like anecdotally talking to just people I know, they're much more aware that there's this campaign to pressure the Walmart Corporation to pay its workers better. So I do feel like the coverage of the whole issue has improved a lot. That said, I'll bet you can go through really wide swaths of the country's media and not get any sense at all that this is a contested issue. Based in large part for what you just said, I mean, I think there's going to be some reluctance to make such a large influential corporation angry at coverage. But I will say I'm a little gratified by the extent I feel like that this issue is much better known than it has been in previous years. And I think that's a good thing.
So, Josh Bivens, how, though, does one negotiate between the obvious impulse on the part of Americans to consume, which has been encouraged? I don't know whether you've noticed that already before Thanksgiving, the Christmas advertising started. That feels like an invasion. I don't know if it's an invasion of privacy, but it's certainly an invasion of peace of mind. You don't even get through Thanksgiving now without them bombarding you. I always thought it was that after Thanksgiving, the shopping till you drop mania began. So, is what's happening on the part of all retailers? Have they decided to basically do wall to wall advertising more? Whenever they feel like.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of one of those classic race to the bottoms that we really need to solve sort of with policy and with the collective action issue. In the race to the bottom, it's sort of this. It's the idea that, sometime between roughly Thanksgiving and Christmas, lots and lots of Americans are going to go out and buy a lot of holiday gifts. And retailers know that, and retailers want the biggest slice of that, pie that they can get. And so there's this real race to be the store that opens first and has consumers spend money at their store relative to somebody else's. But if we did something like say, retailers just aren't allowed to be open on Thanksgiving and there's not allowed to be open even on Black Friday, or just did something to sort of take that part of the holidays out of the sort of competitive calculus of all these places, nobody would be worse off. I mean, it's not like I spend extra money because a store opens on Thanksgiving or Black Friday. It's not like the stores overall make less money. It's just clearly that zero-sum game to make sure you claim that customer first. And so I feel like we could, do a lot of good, from my perspective, to just say Thanksgiving is just out of bounds. You just don't get to open your stores. Or even do something like, have a state raise sales taxes really high just for the day of Thanksgiving to say, if you want to open, you're going to pay a price. And I don't think we'd do any damage at all to overall consumer sales. We would just take that sort of destructive part of the zero-sum competition out of the whole calculus. But I think that's what's going on there, is people want to be the first ones to claim consumer dollars in the holiday shopping season.
Now, is there any research, Josh, that indicates whether or not the consumers at Walmart over these frenzied shopping days, where they were open on Thanksgiving and on Black Friday, and because obviously people go to Walmart because the stuff is cheaper, but they don't make the association that the stuff that they buy is cheaper, but at the price of the workers there, the people, the so-called associates that are in the store that people, these customers interact with, these people can't make a living wage. They then in turn depend upon you, the shopper, to subsidize their health care and their food stamps and other public benefits that they require to get because their employers simply don't pay them enough, and that the vast profits that Walmart earns, $17 billion per year, are going to this family of heirs who, if you count them in with the Koch brothers, the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth wealthiest Americans are either Kochs or Waltons.
Yeah, I think this is another example of sort of that collective action problem. I mean, you see a lot in sort of opinion surveys that people indicate a willingness to pay a little extra to buy what they buy at these retailers if they could be assured that extra they were paying would actually show up as higher wages and benefits for the workers. But there's no real immediate connection to then saying, so if I don't shop at this place, wages will go up at Walmart, because there is no obvious connection between those two things. And so I think that's where you have the disconnect between people shop at Walmart, even if they don't necessarily approve of the labor practices or the wage and compensation there. And you can't just take the fact that people continue to go through the doors as evidence that they don't care about the labor compensation, or they're even hostile to the movement to get higher wages at these retailers. And the other issue is it may be, you know, you are willing to pay a little extra in order to see the workers at these places get higher wages, but you're not willing to, say, you know, have a lower standard, living standard than your neighbor who is not willing to make that trade-off and go there. Instead, what you need is to have sort of a collective solution, either policy, you know, substantial increase in the minimum wage that helps finance wage increases for a lot of the people who work at these large retailers, or something like that. And so I think that's the thing that solves the apparent contradiction between lots of people still go to these big box retailers, and yet lots of people would still be willing to pay a little more if they could be assured that that little more would show up as higher wages and benefits for the workers who work at those places.
So, Josh Bivens, tell us about your research that finds this extraordinary, you know, we know about the growing disparity in wealth in this country, but clearly the Waltons family are the poster children for this disparity, when you consider that, according to your research, from 2007 to 2010, median American family wealth declined 38.8%, while the wealth of the Walmart heirs rose 22.1%, making the Walton family fortune equal to the wealth of the bottom 49 million American households. It's just shocking when you read that.
It is. I mean, and I think there's a couple things there. I think on the one hand, sort of the family fortune of the Waltons compared to the working conditions of the people who largely staff their stores, you know, it's a symbol of the huge increase in economic inequality. Inequality of wages, incomes, wealth that has characterized the country over the past three decades. And then on the other hand, you know, Walmart is actually a big enough employer at this point. I mean, they're the single biggest private employer in the United States economy. That it goes beyond just symbol. I mean, the sort of labor conditions and sort of the contours of the low-wage labor market across big parts of this country are actually influenced by what the Walmart Corporation decides to do with regards to their workers. For example, it would be very, very hard to undertake, say, a campaign to raise wages at competitors to Walmart unless Walmart's wages actually went up, because the competitors could rightly say, we just can't do that. Walmart is so big, and their wages there are low, and so we'll be undercut unless we can figure out some way to engineer an across-the-board wage increase. So it's not just symbol. It's also the fact that this has become kind of the marginal employer, you know, the one that sort of sets the standards for a huge swath of the retail industry across the country. The other thing I would just add, too, that to me, there's the issue of the number about how many, you know, the Walton family has more wealth than the bottom 40-something million American families combined. The more shocking thing to me is if you even take the median wealth in the United States in 2010, and this is, you know, the typical family. They have more wealth than half of all the people in the United States. They have less wealth than half. It would take about 1.1 million of these typical families to equal the combined net worth of the Walton family in 2010. So a lot of people quibble with the number about, you know, the Walton family has more wealth than the bottom 40 million, because they're like, oh, you've got all these college students who have student debt, but they're going to be fine in 10 years, and so that's not a real number. But it still takes a city's worth of typical American families to add up to that overall wealth number. So, as you say, the sheer magnitude of the disparity between sort of the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and typical Americans is just staggering these days. And in the case of Walmart, it's just incredibly emblematic about how tied up that increase in wealth disparity is with the ability of powerful employers in this country to not give wage increases to the vast majority of their workforce.
But Josh Bivens, it doesn't necessarily make any economic sense, this Walmart model, to be this greedy and have such disregard for your employees. The Costco, for example, pays their employees a living wage with full benefits, and that's a very profitable company. So What is it about the Walton heirs? These, you know, what are they, just greedy rednecks? Why are they the way they are? If you don't have to conduct your businesses this way, you can actually have a decent arrangement with your workers. That's a win-win, as in the case of Costco.
I would say a couple things. I mean, one, I think, you know, you have Walmart and then you have sort of the larger American political economy over the past couple of decades, which is we have given enormous incentives for corporations and very well-placed economic actors to pursue this, you know, call it a low road strategy, this strategy of making sure your profits are high by ensuring that wages of your employees don't rise very fast. You know, if you look at the policy maneuvers we've undertaken for the past three decades, we've allowed the inflation-adjusted value, the minimum wage, to go just get battered for decades at a time by rising inflation without raising it. It is still today far below its historic high that it reached in the late 1960s. We have an economy that's literally twice as productive, producing twice as much per hour on average as we did in the late 1960s, and yet we have a minimum wage that's lower. We've also had policy that has basically not kept the playing field level at all between unions and the employers who are trying to break unions, and we've basically made it very cheap for employers to go the union-busting route by not imposing enough sanctions. And we've also decreased marginal tax rates enormously on very top incomes. And so we've sort of moved, you know, basically changed all the rules of the game over the past three decades to encourage corporations to take the route that Walmart has taken. In some sense, you know, to my mind, you kind of have to explain why companies like Costco have chosen the way they have. They're kind of swimming against the tide. They're kind of ignoring a lot of the incentives and a lot of the easy routes to higher profits, which I think they should be commended for. But it's asking a lot for corporations to ignore all these incentives that we've given them to go the low road. And so to my mind, we have to block the low road. I mean, we have to make sure policy does not make it easy for the Walmarts of the world to operate the way they do and push people to trying to make profits and in a healthy way. So I think it's of those two companies that are often sort of contrasted with each other, Costco is really the outlier. You know, you could say Walmart could do as well by treating their workers better. I'm a little agnostic on that. I think it would be fine for them to do a little bit less well and have their workers do quite a bit better. So I think it's not necessarily the case that you have to explain the behavior of Walmart given the sort of policy incentives we've given over the past couple of decades. You actually have to explain the high road companies.
Well, is there anything, just in closing, Josh Bivens, that the National Labor Relations Boards can do? You know, the Republicans Senate were filibustering appointees to that board going to the mat. So clearly there's an agenda here since the Republicans are so zealous in their defense of billionaires. So what's going on here in terms of, you know, given that we, the taxpayers, have to make up for, you know, the deficit in health care and a living wage that the Walmart employees have because of these disgusting owners of this company and the managers of this company who simply don't want to – they'd like to make it TV commercials calling them associates and having them all smiling for the camera. But the reality is these people can't make a living wage and depend upon the taxpayer for food stamps and health care. So the taxpayer has a stake in this. So is there anything that can be done through the National Labor Relations Board?
I think through them. I also think we need sort of a much broader campaign to raise wages in the United States, you know, and not even just at the low retail end. I mean, if you look over the past couple of decades, you really have to get to the 90th, 95th percentile of wage earners to see people whose hourly wages have actually kept up with the sort of underlying productivity growth in the economy, which is basically the benchmark for what wages could have grown at. We had a period in the late 1990s where wages...
Hello, did we lose this call? Is Josh back? Could you finish your thought, Josh? You got cut off. Sorry.
Yeah, and so, one, we need to get back to very low rates of unemployment sooner rather than later. Nothing boosts bargaining power of workers like low rates of unemployment. Two, we need a higher value of the minimum wage, and we need to make sure it doesn't get battered by inflation over time, so we should index it to something so it is a meaningful labor standard forevermore. And then three, we should make it much easier for willing workers to form unions and force employers to bargain collectively with them. There was the Employee Free Choice Act a couple years ago that was floating around Congress and never went anywhere. It can be something like that, but we've got a majority of American workers who either are in a union or want to be in a union, and yet we have the lowest number on record who actually are bargaining collectively with their employers, and we need something to fill in that gap, and that something is policy that tilts the playing field back to give willing workers a fair chance to organize. And so I think we need to think big about boosting wages and not just relying on, like you say, these public transfer programs to give people decent living standards. We need both. We need the transfers, but we also need workers with the bargaining power that they can actually get some wage increases from their employers.
Well, I appreciate you joining us here because the contrast between there's a broader issue here, and that is the extent to which we still are a democracy, you know, because the wealthy, since Citizens United, can buy our politics, and we clearly have if you've got the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th richest Americans either being a Coke or a Walton, and if you add up their total or their fortune, it's extraordinary. So you see the enormous power they have. If politics for sale, then they've got the game sewn up. So there has to be some countervailing movement here to level the playing field.
That's right. And I think that's, in one way, that is what is so promising about the sort of Walmart campaign, is that it's, because these are kind of abstract issues. When you can talk about we need, you know, a broad-based campaign to raise American wages, their trailing productivity and numbers, and it gets all very abstract pretty quickly. Pointing to a corporation whose owners have this enormous fortune and who their employees interface with Americans all the time and are in such sort of stark economic circumstances, I think that really has a chance to be a catalyst to move these issues to really the front burner of American politics. And so it's a shame that Walmart has the labor practices it has. I think it's really good that there's a real spotlight being shined on them, and it's actually casting this broader, unequal economy we have in very stark relief.
Well, Josh Bivens, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Bivens, who's a research and policy director at the Economic Policy Institute. He's the author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches Us About Globalization. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not the healthcare.gov site is up and running and that Obamacare is going to work in the future.
You receive, but always want more. But the day is coming, the day is near, the day is coming, you know what I mean. The day is eyes, and so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ron Pollock, who's the founding executive director of Families USA, the National Organization for Healthcare Consumers. Families USA's mission is to achieve high-quality, affordable healthcare coverage for everyone in the U.S. In 1997, Mr. Pollock was appointed by President Clinton as the sole consumer representative on the President's Advisory Commission on Consumer Protection and Quality in the Healthcare Industry. In that capacity, Mr. Pollock helped prepare the Patient's Bill of Rights that has been enacted in many states. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ron Pollock.
Good to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
And the White House had a press conference by phone this morning, and basically, I guess the bottom line, as far as the White House is concerned, is that healthcare.gov on December the 1st is night and day from what it was on October the 1st. That's coming from their special tech troubleshooter, Jeff Seintz. Obviously, this is the important because they did promise in a month's time to be up and running. What's your understanding of what is the status of healthcare.gov?
Well, healthcare.gov is in much better shape than it has been before. It is the expectation that as many as 50,000 people can go online at the same time, 800,000 over the course of the day. And so there's a reasonable expectation that a good number of people can get enrolled and get coverage fairly soon. They can learn about their options. They can seek to become eligible for very substantial premium subsidies that will make health coverage more affordable. So hopefully this is the beginning, again, of what will be a realistic process of getting many millions of people with new coverage.
Well, according to Jeff Seintz, the tech troubleshooter that was brought in, he says that the new hardware upgrades made Friday quadruple the registration capacity and response times are under 1 second with an error rate below 1%. And apparently they have a feature there in it is if you can't get on or if you have any kind of problems getting on or finishing logging on, they send you an email and tell you when you can come back again. So I guess what's going to happen now, first of all, a lot of people I think are probably being deterred. You've got to win those people back. But also, I presume now that the holidays are over, more and more people are going to start trying it, right? So what's your sense of what's going to happen in the next couple of days, Ron?
Well, we know that there are huge numbers of people who are very interested in getting coverage through the Affordable Care Act. In the first month, there were close to 30 million people who tried to get online or called into the toll-free phone number. And that shows that the interest is very high and that people very much are looking forward to getting health coverage. For too many people, they're locked out of the healthcare system because they can't afford insurance premiums. Now, because they will be eligible either for these premium subsidies or the expansion of Medicaid, many of these people can get coverage. And so I think we're going to see a very significant number of people try to get onto the website over the days and weeks ahead.
But if 30 million tried previously, and since October the 1st, when healthcare.gov started to crash and burn, there's been nothing but negative publicity since then. And it's both criticism, I mean, you know, almost gleeful criticism from Republicans and very defensive criticism from Democrats. There's no question that the public, as far as they're concerned, are pretty leery. So how are you going to get those 30 million people back?
Well, the bottom line is that people very much want to get health care coverage and have had real difficulties for many years. A lot of people with pre-existing health conditions like asthma or diabetes or high blood pressure or history of cancer have been shut out of America's health care system because insurers refused to provide coverage to them. Or if they were willing to provide coverage, they charged a discriminatory premium. This is something of the past with the Affordable Care Act. And so many millions of people who feel it's really important for themselves and their families to get health coverage are no doubt going to go onto the website. Now, you know, the website is really the technology of the system. It's not really the heart of the system. And so I think people care about getting the coverage. And with the technology improved, I think we're going to see very many millions of people try to get enrolled, and presumably they will get enrolled fairly soon.
Now, Ron, what's your organization going to do now then to assuage people, you know, those that have already been turned off? Because you have to admit, the news has been pretty bad up until now. And, I mean, obviously the White House wants to try and attract people back to healthcare.gov, but I would think, given the negative propaganda, this is going to take some effort, isn't it? And in terms of your organization, what are you planning on doing to encourage people?
Well, it's very important to understand that this first enrollment period lasts 6 months. We've only experienced 2 months of that, and so the six-month period is rather long. And I think that what drives people here is the need for healthcare. This is not like buying any other commodity, like a television set or a car or a refrigerator. People care deeply about making sure that they and their families can stay healthy, and if they get sick, that they can get care. And so I don't think that the fact that there have been significant technological problems are going to deter people from trying to get enrolled in coverage that they were unable to get before the Affordable Care Act was enacted into law. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to continue to reach out to the many millions of people who have been shut out of the healthcare system in the past, or who increasingly have difficulty paying for premiums, to let them know that health is on the way and here's how they can get enrolled. And I'm presuming that because of this deep interest in getting health coverage and care for families, for family members, they will not be deterred.
There was a very comprehensive article in the New York Times, Ron Pollack, Inside the Race to Rescue a Healthcare Site and Obama. And it's a sort of forensic examination of what went wrong. And apparently, in terms of the technical side, apparently several experts say that the errors in the software code written to stitch the Oracle product into the online system and improperly configured hardware trapped users in an endless technological loops. And this, of course, again, obviously people are very frustrated about it. But in this article, you learn quite a bit about what went on in the White House with their relations with the insurance industries. And the insurance companies, of course, are in a position to do well out of the Affordable Care Act, assuming it works out as advertised. But they and the White House have had a bit of a to and fro here. And as you know, a lot of people got notices that their insurance was being canceled. That created a panic. The Republicans piled on and were stirring the pot as much as they could on that. And various Democratic senators, in particular Mary Landrieu and others, apparently screamed at the White House. So there's been according to this New York Times investigative piece, there's been quite a lot of drama behind the scenes. What's your understanding, Ron Pollack, of where the insurance companies stand on this? Are they still on board, or are they ambivalent? Because some of them appear to, you know, have gone out of their way to be unhelpful, shall we say.
Well, most insurance companies stand to gain significantly as millions of people gain health coverage for the first time. They'll have more customers. So the insurance industry as a whole, I think, wants to make sure that the Affordable Care Act works so that many more people can get health care coverage. But it's very important, by the way, to keep a perspective about these so-called terminations of people who had individual health insurance policies and received a termination notice from their insurance companies. Altogether today, there are approximately 15 million people who have individual health insurance coverage. That's about 5% of the American population. And of course, not all of them receive termination notices. It is only those people in plans that have been considered substandard. But what's really important to understand is that 3 out of 4 people who are receiving these termination notices are now eligible for premium subsidies that they weren't eligible for before. So when they learn about the new offerings in through the Affordable Care Act, they will find out, most of them, that they are better off today or with the Affordable Care Act than they were before. And so I think we're going to see a lot of people find that the offerings in the Affordable Care Act will provide them with much greater help than they had before, and it will make coverage much more affordable.
But when you say they'll learn about it, Ron Pollack, how will they learn about it? Because, again, I have to emphasize that there's been an awful lot of negative publicity here.
Yes, people are going to learn about this through a number of different ways. One, of course, is the website, and hopefully the website is going to work much better, as the administration believes it will. Secondly, they can learn about it through calling a toll-free line where they can talk to somebody and get specific information that's applicable to their circumstances. Thirdly, there are different groups of organizations, often called navigators or assisters, that are being used to try to help people learn about and get enrolled in coverage. They are there to provide in-person assistance so that when people are trying to navigate the application for enrollment, they get the help that is needed. So there will be a number of ways people will learn about it. And by the way, I think we're going to see insurance companies and a lot of nonprofit organizations do a great deal of public outreach and advertising about the new opportunities. So there will be plenty of opportunities for people to learn about how they can benefit through the Affordable Care Act.
Well, in California, of course, the Californian Health Exchange is up and running and is very successful, and people are finding that their new policies are incredibly advantageous and almost night and day compared to what they had before, because of so much discrimination has been prevented by these new laws. What is, though, the overall national picture here? With so many Republican governors basically not taking Medicaid, which is no skin off their nose. There's no reason not to do it, but they're not. There seems to be a kind of mean-spirited, almost vindictiveness out there, wanting to sabotage anything that this administration comes up with. But if California is an example of how things are working out well at a state level, what's the overall picture comparing California to some of these sort of red states, particularly these kind of feudal states in the South?
Well, we're seeing significant outreach and enrollment in a number of the states that are running their own marketplaces, California being a good illustration of that, but there are other states as well, Kentucky and Connecticut and New York. They're doing very well with respect to their outreach and enrollment. Now, with respect to the Medicaid expansion, about half the states in the country have now accepted the Medicaid expansion. The other half have not. But it's interesting that there are now 10 Republican governors who were strongly opposed to the Affordable Care Act who have said the Medicaid expansion is good for my state and I support it. So you have governors like New Jersey Governor Christie, Arizona Governor Brewer, Ohio Governor Kasich, and a number of others who are steadfast opponents to the Affordable Care Act said this Medicaid expansion is a terrific deal, and we want our state to get the benefit of it. And it is a great deal because in the first 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, the federal government picks 100% of the costs, and the state doesn't pay anything. And thereafter, it never goes below 90% what the federal government pays for. And in the process, states are actually going to save money because many states have to pay for the uncompensated care costs of uninsured people when they go to an emergency room at a public hospital. When more of these people get health coverage through Medicaid, the states will be relieved of those costs. So this is a great deal for the states, and I believe that the other Republican governors who so far have not said yes, that they ultimately will say yes because it's too good a deal.
Well, what can be done, though, it just seems so cruel and unusual to deny American citizens rights that other parts of the country have and are enjoying. And I imagine at some point or other, maybe people in these states will realize what's happening in other states, assuming everything works out, and California being an example of how it can work out well. So just in closing, Ron Pollock, what is your sense then of what can be done to help people who are being denied the benefits of healthcare reform by political vindictiveness?
Well, it's very important to know that some of the key groups in the healthcare field that are not identified as being Democrats, but are often Republicans, are telling their Republican friends that it really does make sense to expand the Medicaid program. Certainly hospital leaders are doing that. Many of the key physician organizations are doing that. And even local chambers of commerce that often align themselves with Republicans are saying this is a good deal. And I think that when somebody in North Carolina, which is not a state that has accepted the Medicaid expansion, learned that their tax dollars that are going to Washington are being spent in California or New York or Ohio or Arizona for people in those states so that they get help, but that money is not coming back to North Carolina, I think we're going to see people say that this is a bad decision. And what's really interesting, if you look at the five deep southern states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina, surveys have shown that the population in those states think that their governors should implement the Medicaid expansion. So I think over time it will happen.
Well, Ron Pollock, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ron Pollock, who is the founding executive director of Families USA, the National Organization for Healthcare Consumers. Families USA's mission is to achieve high-quality, affordable healthcare coverage for everyone in the U.S. In 1997, Mr. Pollock was appointed by President Clinton as the sole consumer representative on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Consumer Protection and Quality in the Healthcare Industry. In that capacity, Mr. Pollock helped prepare the Patient's Bill of Rights that has been enacted in many states. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a discussion about whether the Pope is a radical reformer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer O'Malley, a Roman Catholic woman priest and a program administrator for the special education programs at Compton Unified School District. She has done research on disproportionately and the use of peaceable classroom techniques to stop the school to jail pipeline, and she previously worked as a coordinator of youth ministry at a parish in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles and was a program director for the National Catholic Service Learning Program. She's also involved in ministry with the gay and lesbian community and a member of the Call to Action group committed to church justice. And also joining us is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a former New York Times religion editor, and he's the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer O'Malley and Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jennifer, how could you be a Roman Catholic woman priest and yet, as far as I know, even in the last statements from the Pope, which have gotten so much international attention, as much as he's made some breathtakingly interesting remarks about reforming the Church, he reiterated that the ordination of women is not on the table.
Sure, we're a group of Roman Catholic women who started in 2002, and our first bishops were ordained by a Roman Catholic male bishop who remains in good standing today. in secret, of course. So, you know, we're a group who are just continuing to fight for the rights of women within the church and making the connection even with this latest statement that until women are fully recognized in the church, the injustice of living wages and poverty, which affects women and children the most, cannot be fully eradicated.
And so just before we get to Ken, did you what's your overall impression of the latest document from the Pope?
You know, again, I think there's some wonderful statements on economics, and it brings really a lot of hope, a change in tone, for sure, from what we've had over the past few decades. But again, until the church is willing to recognize the rights of women, it's not going to change the situation of women and children around the world economically.
And Kenneth Briggs, what's your response to the Pope's latest encyclical, I guess, it's, if that's the right word?
Well, I agree, first of all, with the idea that without without the equality of women in the church, the rest of it is kind of moot discussion, even though it won't get played that way. I think the statement on economics is, of course, it touches an incredibly moral issue, and one that I think is one that the church needs to hear. It's been stated, in the past, I mean, starting with Jesus, who stated it, and then right up through from Pope Leo XIII in the 1890s, right up through, almost every pope has stated the principles. The problem isn't that the issue is defined and stated. The problem has been whether anybody can do anything about it, because the Catholic world generally has brushed it aside every other time that it's come up economic justice has to be done, and then pretty much ignores the contents of the statement. So I think it's important, and I think it's significant, and I think it touches on the right issue. But unless there's a program to go with it or something that the church is willing to do itself in that regard, just like on the issue of women, I don't think it goes anywhere.
Well, Jennifer O'Malley, just as somebody that tries to cover economics and economic injustice and the growing disparity of wealth in this country, and we just got through early in the program talking about how on this Black Friday, all of those demonstrations against Walmart, the Walton heirs, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, have the equivalent wealth of the bottom 49 million American households. So when the Pope says, and this is quoting him from, it's called Pope Francis's first apostolic exhortation, quoting, "Some people continue to defend trickle-down theories which assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system." That's certainly in line with today's discussion, I would say.
Absolutely. I think, you know, again, this change of tone or these statements on economics are great. But as Ken said, until the church is willing to put something in place to actually do something about the statement, it's unlikely that we'll see change. And we know within the church itself that sometimes the wages paid or when folks attempt to unionize church workers, that they come up against unwillingness on behalf of those running institutions by the church. So until the church is in the hierarchy is willing to make some change within itself, I don't think a statement as this, as powerful as it can be, will be as powerful as it could be without the backing of a system of change.
So, Kenneth Briggs, the Pope apparently met in September, had a private meeting with Gustavo Gutierrez, a Peruvian Catholic priest associated with liberation theology. And as you know, the previous two popes really had a kind of jihad against liberation theology. Is there any sense that there's going to be a change in that tone? In other words, you know, we're talking, in effect, in foreign policy terms here. Will the Vatican have a different foreign policy, if not a different domestic policy?
I think it will lighten up in its criticism. But his predecessor, who condemned liberation theology, lives probably 100 yards from him and the Vatican. And I think this is largely a matter of personal reconciliation. He was alienated with a lot of the advocates of liberation theology in the past. And I think he wants to kind of open up those channels again. And I think it's good on a human relations point of view, but I don't think it has much implication for the church's overall policies, except perhaps to make the church a little more accepting of things when they happen rather than exactly endorsing them, which is not again, the problem here is there are no implications for church members when it comes to the economics. You can go ahead and the church has been an enormous beneficiary of the capitalist, super capitalist, unfettered capitalist system, and continues to be, with an inner circle of very rich Catholics who, you know, one might assume might make the tyranny of money part of their lives without being judging each one of them. But the church has a big problem here in terms of actually carrying through something like that within its own terms. But lay people can ignore completely these kinds of things. But on the questions of sexual ethics and so on, there are penalties involved. So it's not apples and oranges.
Well, it would seem, though, that let me ask Jennifer O'Malley, do you think that there will be a different tone then in if the Pope setting an example by not riding around in limousines and not living in palaces, and you've got the role of wealthy Catholics that Kenneth Briggs has just mentioned being pandered to by the hierarchy, when the head of the church is now saying, and I don't know whether in terms of the of his change about or rumors of change about liberation theology, we know that there were some very negative stories about this Pope initially when he was chosen, because he was there in Argentina during the Dirty War, in which 30,000 people were murdered by their own government and disappeared, and a couple of priests who had been tortured, one of them had accused the Pope of complicity with the junta. Let's start with that. Is there any atonement going on here, or is there a need for an atonement?
I think there's definitely a need for atonement, but I think, as Ken said, the conversations that are happening with Gutierrez and the hope that maybe others who speak out will not be attacked as they have been in the last few decades sets a different tone. But there hasn't been any real change in how things are handled. And, you know, obviously here with the statements made on women in this document, there'll be no change or even opportunity for further conversation about women within leadership roles in the church.
So, Ken, I keep hearing this from both of you, that there's no change. Good atmospherics, wonderful statements. It's refreshing to hear I find his comments on economics very incisive. But beyond rhetoric, you both seem very skeptical.
Well, I think there's good reason to be, because of the history. The United States bishops issued in 1987, I believe, a very strong pastoral statement about the economy, which made most of the same points. One looks at the one who was supposed to be the model for all Christian behavior, Jesus, who didn't live in a mansion either, and walked the highways and byways and and shared life with the lowest economic elements. And you'd think, well, there's an example for you. But he said all kinds of negative things about the dangers of being rich and exploiting people and all that kind of stuff. But it hasn't made a whole lot of difference anywhere. So I think there's reason for skepticism in that it seems like a good idea. But boy, the capital greed approach to life offers things that many people in the current age love to have and are not very willing to sacrifice.
Well, I spoke the other day to the theologian who was driven out of the church by Cardinal Ratzinger and subsequently Pope Benedict, Matthew Fox, and he was concerned. He said, made a remark to the effect that, well, if they'll let him live, is there such – I mean, it sounds like those novels about the what, I can't remember, the Da Vinci Code. That's what I'm trying to, yes. Is to give me a sense of fact and fiction there, is it possible that there are such reactionaries in the hierarchy that they'd even contemplate assassinating this pope?
I don't believe the status quo is in any danger. So I don't see a radical threat coming from anywhere. I don't see revolution happening. I mean, I might wish certain things would be stirring right now, but I haven't seen anything. And the translation of what he says to many, many Catholics will be, one should do as well as one can, be charitable and so on, and miss the whole point of the systemic injustice that he's talking about. But again, you can ignore it if you want to, because it's say, well, the Pope doesn't know what he's talking about on those issues. He's got to stick to stuff that he does know.
And Jennifer O'Malley, do you think that this Pope is a sufficient radical, that he could be threatened, or is he not? Both of you are indicating he's not really that revolutionary.
Yeah, I don't see the status quo changing also. I don't see structures within the church changing. I don't see for any call with a real plan of to change societal structures as far as economics go. So, and again, this is not a new call going back to, you know, Pope Leo with condition of labor and his statement on workers' rights. We've had this throughout our history, but it hasn't had a real impact. I don't see there being a real threat to Pope Francis.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Jennifer O'Malley, Roman Catholic woman priest and program administrator for the special education programs at the Compton Unified School District. Also, she's involved in the ministry with the gay and lesbian community and a member of the Call to Action, a group committed to church justice. And also joining us was Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a former New York Times religion editor and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. I thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.